If you could go back a couple of minutes there, I don't quite know where I ran out of tape and had to change it, but...
Yes, well, here... I landed as slow as I could and as far down this side. It was quite steep there, but it was cleared off for some reason.
Well, the airport at Ruby now is on top of the hill.
Yeah,
it
that's farther up on the same
right,
ridge.
This, you were partway down the hill.
Well, we were right to the bluff where it drops
see.
Into the Yukon.
Yeah.
That was part of that field, ball field.
Yeah.
Ball diamond up there. Well, I landed just as short as I could there on the upgrade. See, plunked here because I knew it was downhill on the other side and I had no brakes. Well, I didn't need brakes. So we went over on our back in that soft spot right in the center.
Oh, my.
I had these four people in the back cabin. Norman C. Steins, the big engineer that was FE Company, who was going over to look over the Hammond dredges.
Mm-hmm.
They bought them later, bought out the Hammond Company.
Mm-hmm.
Two or three dredges over there, and they were large dredges. So he and his secretary and another lady friend, Mrs. Dale, I remember her, I forgot the secretary's name, and my brother Ralph in the cabin, and 500 pounds of book material of some kind. It was heavy, and they said at the time it was 500 pounds.
Hmm.
That is baggage and the bookwork for the four people. So they were all in a jumble, flat on the back, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I was jumped out right away. I didn't go very far, and I hardly felt it going over on my back because I was up near the radiator and I could touch my
feet. You were hanging by your seatbelt.
Yes. Oh, yes. So I sat right beside the six-cylinder BMW engine.
Yeah. You climbed out on the left side on
Climbed right out quick, and I was up on the wing and opening the door before they got unjumbled in there. It was a six-passenger cabin is what it was. Well, five comfortably, three across on the wide seat, and then two movable chairs that were tied down with one single cable in the center. But there was an awful lot of room in that cabin. Six or four could sit on that wide seat. Well, anyway, we got them out, and they didn't like that. They called Norman Steins, hadn't been flying, of course, and he says, well, we're not going to do that anymore. And they hired a boat.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't go on with you.
No, I couldn't have taken off with them.
Sure.
Impossible, with all that baggage, too. But I did take off with Dick Wood and my brother Ralph, and gas enough to go to Nome, 300 miles.
You had to bring a new prop down, did you?
Dick Wood, the president of our company, and the banker here, president of the bank, and a fellow named Young, in a fast boat, brought the propeller down. I forgot how long, a couple days, I guess. But we had the airplane sitting right side up. But first I'll tell you about the work of how we did it. The whole town of Ruby was up there every day helping. So we had quite a few fellas that were able to... We had to take the bolts out of the wing. Here it was upside down, and the wing was lying on the ground, of course. So we unbolted it. Then we had a number of men lift the engine part, the fuselage, up, and then others pulled the wing, dragged it straight out sideways to get it out from under. Then we were able to roll the fuselage over on its wheels. And then, a little later, all could get under the wing, walked up over the tail, and walked it up, lifting the 900-pound wing right up in place again. Got the bolts back in. Just four bolts. It was simple to assemble. Just one place to put them, and that was all. The rudder had been damaged a little and went over, but the ladies of Ruby got their sewing out and sewed it up, and we had to rebend. It was metal tubing frame in the balanced rudder. That was a balanced rudder because it had no fin in front of it.
Oh, yeah.
And it was to a new pilot, it was always hard to get the thing to stop wiggling. First time I got in it, my feet went like this.
I see.
And
yeah.
The pedals in front were not a bar.
Mm-hmm.
They were pedals hinged at the bottom and this way, just up and down, hinged in the back, just the length of a foot.
Mm-hmm.
So it just, they flipped back and forth, and you mm-hmm. couldn't stop them somehow. It wasn't pressure at all. Mm-hmm. They just started going this way, and the rudder was going this way.
Yeah.
It's kind of a funny feeling. And finally I got in New York, I tested it, see, mm-hmm. in Garden City, Curtis Field, Garden City. It's where I tested it. So I got used to it before I came to Alaska, which I'm very glad I did. And you just hold your feet tight, solid. Don't push. Pretty soon you can do it just enough, mm-hmm. and you handle it just fine. No trouble at all. But gee whiz, you start that. So, I was saying that it had no fin on it, see, mm-hmm. it was poor balance that way. But otherwise, it was good, long fuselage, see, mm-hmm. it worked fine. They used these same airplanes on their first airlines in Europe,
mm-hmm.
KLM and Lufthansa, mm-hmm. both used them. They had other models of the same thing, too, different engines and such, but the same airplane,
mm-hmm.
Fokker F3. They were a good airplane and a very good engine. Big six-cylinder, 5-inch bore, 7-inch stroke.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that. 235 to 250 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
Wooden propeller, turned 1,400 revs.
Mm-hmm.
Top speed.
Mm-hmm.
That is top on the ground. It was a very reliable engine. That never missed a shot at any time.
That was your first trip to Nome.
That was first trip to Nome. So I took off then with Ralph and Dick Wood, and I scraped down through the brush on the lower side of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember whether we cut any little higher trees or bushes out, but Ralph said later, gee, good, I saw the brush coming out right here on the side.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't enough to stop me or to catch in the cross axle gear.
Mm-hmm.
Made it, just made it. But another 100 pounds of weight in there, I might not have made it.
Yeah.
So we flew on, but the engine vibrated a little because the crankshaft had been bent from breaking the propeller.
Mm-hmm.
But not too much. We got by fine, and I flew it into Nome, and we were there 10 days. 10 days before we got the right weather for me to fly nonstop back on 90 gallons of gas.
Hmm.
It cruised at 90, 95.
Mm-hmm. Low. That's pretty good speed for those days.
Yeah, low mm-hmm. cruising
yeah.
power. I wanted, had to be economical to make it.
I see.
And I had about an inch of gas left in that tank when I arrived in Fairbanks. 7 hours even. Right on the button.
Well, where did you land at Nome at that time?
We landed at Fort Davis.
Davis,
that's...
Yeah, down the mouth of Nome River.
Nome River.
Yeah.
Mouth of Nome River.
You landed on the east side of the Nome River.
West side. Oh, no, yeah.
On the east side. Yeah, that's where
east
Fort
side.
Davis was.
Yeah.
Well, where did you land there, on the beach, or was there a road there, or what?
That was a beach, and
I
you
see.
Know, 1920, when the New York to Nome flyers came over,
mm-hmm.
they hauled manure, straw and manure from town out there, and they made a 600-foot runway
oh, yeah.
near the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And they always had to take off from the buildings down to the mouth of the river.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no trouble landing over the buildings and on this part of it without running off.
Mm-hmm.
And I made 2 passenger hops. We had very little gas in Nome.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted good aviation gas. It was the regular, of course, mm-hmm. more or less a regular gas, but it was what they called aviation gas that they'd had for the Nome Flyers, New York, the Nome Flyers, and another Jenny that had been there before I arrived,
mm-hmm.
shipped up to Nome. Well, they had just enough. I had enough in the tanks, I believe, to make 2 hops.
Mm-hmm.
Now remember, this engine, when you got low on gas, you had fuel enough to last quite a while, but it would make a miss. The whole engine go
mm-hmm.
and then catch
mm-hmm.
when the gas was low in the tank. Gravity feed, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was from the wing, and the engine was right here.
Yeah.
It wasn't too far a gravity drop. And Ada had her first ride with me then in 1925. There were 4 of them. I took the 4 up, 2 couples. Well, I met her then. She had said, thank you for the nice ride, and I didn't remember her too well until 1927 when he came over with the Hisso Standard to start the first airplane service out of Nome. That's when
That's right, Sheila was born and raised at Nome.
Yes. She was born and raised there.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Well, how long did they use that strip on the beach there before they built another strip somewhere?
They built another strip almost right away.
I see.
That is called the old Bessie Creek Field.
Mm-hmm.
It was out a ways, remember where that old hangar is?
Yeah, where the old red hangar was.
N-A-T hangar.
Yeah, right.
That's the
up
best.
On the hill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kind
Probably
of
the old
slope.
City field.
Yeah, a
yeah.
little slope up there.
Yeah.
They built that, so the next time I came in 27,
mm-hmm.
that's where I was landing.
I see. Well, that wasn't a bad strip.
Oh, no, that was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
This was standard. Oh, there's a lot
yeah.
of them. So everything was nice when I came back in 25.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll never forget the flight back. That was a worrisome thing too. I had no spare tank that it could turn on in any way. It was just the one tank, and when the engine quit, it would be done. See?
Was that tank in the wing?
Yes.
Or in the center section? Or
no, in the wing.
I see.
I don't remember. It could have been right in the center section of the wing. That was
yeah.
a 1.5 feet thick, see?
Yeah, yeah.
There. I think it was,
mm-hmm.
if I remember right. So it wouldn't have overbalanced. But the measuring was liters, I guess, but we figured it out to be 90 gallons.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty good load.
Well, yeah, it was pretty good,
yeah.
pretty fair.
Mm-hmm.
And to fly economical, that's about the maximum flying one of those ships on the gas.
Yeah.
7 hours.
Mm-hmm.
See, I remember I sure had very little gas left.
The old Norseman, we could get a little over 8 hours out of it with a belly tank in there.
Oh, yes, that's a belly tank.
Had a 77-gallon belly tank the way the military had the
airplane.
Oh,
yeah, 77-gallon.
Most of the operators finally took that tank out and made a baggage compartment down underneath
yeah.
for engine covers and firefox and
yeah.
stuff like that. And
how much gas in the wings then?
I think it was about 65 gallons, something like that.
Oh,
yeah.
That wasn't too much for that 550.
Well, we had,
thank you.
I guess we had about 5 hours of fuel.
Oh, that much, huh?
Yeah.
That'd be economical flying. Hmm.
It was,
Did
pretty good. That was a pretty good old airplane. It was a tough airplane.
Oh, yes.
That's one of the toughest gears on it of any airplane
yeah.
I ever flew, you know.
Yeah.
For skis, you know.
I knew the designer. RBC Nordyne. Mm-hmm. Nordyne Norseman. That's what they were called. Mm-hmm. He was with Fokker Company when I met him. That's when I bought this Fokker for the company. Yes, that was a sturdy airplane, and he was a good designer. He was a Dutchman, too, from Holland. Very nice fellow. Yeah, they were good. We in Airlines had five, six, or seven of them total, and I never flew it once. Mm-hmm. My son Richard, youngest son, flew them a lot. Mm-hmm. So did Merrill and the other pilots. I was flying the 170s and 180 in that time, see. Easy airplanes to fly. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when Sig first brought that 195 over, Cessna.
Oh, yeah.
And he came down from Kotzebue with it that day, you know, and we were on the old city field there at Nome when he came in over Newton Peak up there, you know, and that thing looked just like a streak coming down across there, you know. We thought that was a pretty fast airplane at that time.
Oh, it was, too.
And it worked out pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Good airplane.
I flew that first one up from the factory.
Well, that's probably the one that was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I suppose it was.
Because he'd come from, I think he went from Fairbanks over to Kotzebue or something that time.
And, mm-hmm.
Then came on down to Nome with it.
They were
but fine he was flying the Blanc all the time at that time, you know. In those days, the mail used to go from Fairbanks and Anchorage to Nome, and then Weens in Alaska would fly it up during Campbell Kotzebue.
Yeah.
And then it was all redistributed out of Kotzebue to the up the Kobuk and the Noatak and up the coast to Point Hope there, Point Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And then the barrel mail all went through there.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's right.
For quite a while, Sig was up there in Barrel, and they used to fly the mail up to Barrel or up to Point Lay.
That's right.
And the pilot would come down from Kotzebue or from Barrow to Wainwright and Point Lay and pick the mail up and take it on back up, and their pilot would wait and pick up the mail at Point Lay and take it on down to Kotzebue, and it would go on down to Nome and from Nome over to Fairbanks and Anchorage.
That's right.
But there was tons and tons of mail travel that way.
You know? It sure did.
Quite a bit later that they started flying direct from Fairbanks to Barrow. Then it was distributed from Barrow down the coast to.
Yes, that's right. I think.
Really wasn't any airports up in that country at that time. They used to land on the beaches, you know, with big tires. They'd get one of those airplanes with big tires, or use floats, one or the other.
That's right.
Well, then I used to fly the old Pilgrim, you know. Alaska had one of those old Pilgrims over there for years.
Oh, that's
right.
That
was a real good airplane. That kind of reminded me of that Fokker, you know, where you sit up in the front on the thing. You climbed up the right-hand side and opened the door, and you sat down in the cockpit up there. And of course, it was only the one cockpit. You had a stick in the middle and the throttle on the left, and you sat right on top of the engine almost, looked right down on top of the engine. You could look out the left wing and see under the wing and over the wing, same way on the right side. And then right in back of the seat there was a little square window that was your only it was the only way you could talk to the passengers back there.
Yes.
It was a nine-place airplane.
That's right.
Nine people back there. And they'd open that little window, you know, and talk to you through there.
That's the one you were flying with Daisy, the public health service nurse?
No.
Yes? No.
I don't think so.
When you went over on your back, where was that?
That was with an old Gold and Stinson.
Why don't that was the...
Anyhow, that Pilgrim was great in air for me. Did you ever have occasion to fly the Pilgrim?
No. All those late airplanes, I didn't fly.
Well, see, Gillen was flying those things on that mail run down to McGrath out of here.
He sure did.
I don't know what year it first came over here. Frank Barr had one. He was flying up here.
Yes, they were a good airplane, or those pilots wouldn't have liked them.
Mm-hmm. You got into administration, I think.
Yes, quite soon, around 1955. Mm-hmm. And I was flying the Cessnas from 1950 and on. As soon as the 170s came out, I just stuck by the smaller airplanes around out of Fairbanks here.
Now, what did you do during the war? Oh, World War II?
I was flying out of Fairbanks.
And what were you flying in that period of the early 40s then?
Stinsons.
Were you?
Yes. Gullwings. Oh, well, we had, from 1936 and on, we had Cessna Air Masters up to 1939. I was flying them right along in 1940. And then we had Stinsons and Cessnas. 40 to 45 during the war, and I was flying them till 1948 thereabouts. We went out to Seattle for a short period. Ada wanted to go out and have the kids go to some outside schools, so we missed a year or so there in the late 40s. Then came back.
You started to tell me about, you said that you had met Ada on that first flight over there to Nome.
Yes, I met her, and she had thanked me for the ride, but, you know, I had to admit to her I didn't remember her too well. She says something about you were too busy talking to some of the other girls, people around there.
Sounds just like a woman.
She says, but I came up to you and thanked you for the ride. It was a nice ride, and she got a great thrill out of it. Then she heard Ralph say, gee, I heard the engine miss on the takeoff there. Boy, that was close, he says. She got a great kick out of that, you know. Thrilled, you know. Being single and ready for excitement.
Well, how was the weather coming back from Nome that time? You said it was kind of a...
Oh, it was good. Good weather. We waited 10 days.
I see.
Well, a total of 10 days.
Yeah.
Not exactly. Maybe the last 5 days we were waiting for it to be clear by the signal corps stations all the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you go right over Quick on that? Return over Moses Point and Quick?
Yes.
And across the Nalato
Hills? Crossed straight over. I made as straight a line as I could because I knew I couldn't safely land at Tanana. Mm-hmm. The parade ground there wasn't quite large enough. Okay, mm-hmm. For HISO standards. Ninana had only a 700-foot field, and I needed 900 feet to land. Mm-hmm. It would run 900 feet every time. Because of no brakes and just a flat shoe for a skid. I stepped it out each time, most of the time on bars and such where I'd land. If I get 1,000 feet, I could get in because I'd land short and use it all for running. Same at Wiseman on the bar in front of the old town of Wiseman.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only place I landed it there, right at Wiseman.
Well, how long did that bunker last then after that, before it was finally broken up?
I flew it again in 1927. 1927 for Fairbanks Airplane Company. I wasn't flying for them then.
Mm-hmm.
But I flew. We had started our own company then in Nome. I came over with the HISO standard and Bob Lavery, who was manager then, wanted to know if I couldn't make a few hops here for him. So I flew their Swallow HISO E 180 horse Swallow biplane, open cockpit, and the Fokker. But I liked the Fokker better than the Swallow.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had good visibility and neither one had brakes.
Mm-hmm.
Fokker took a little more run, both maybe both landing and takeoff. But I liked it very much in the air.
Mm-hmm.
I got the heat from the radiator, which I didn't always need, but it was comfortable, and then my windshield took the air right up over the wing. We had extended the windshield. But at first, there was a short windshield, and it cut in and came on my back.
I see.
And my back would start to ache in an hour, after an hour in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So we extended the windshield, and it was still there in 27.
Mm-hmm.
And it would sail up over that thick wing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very comfortable airplane to fly once mm-hmm. you caught on to it.
Mm-hmm.
The landing and the speed and all. I could stall that in and get tail wheel 10 feet where I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do that to get by those days in 25, so few fields.
Well, in those days later, were you landing on that little strip right above the town at Live and Good?
We were landing across the creek.
Across the creek?
Yeah. On that hay field over across.
When I first landed at Live and Good, it was in the summer of 1950. And I had to go up there with a mail one day. And there was just a little strip right above town.
Yes, they built that later.
I see.
I wasn't flying the Fokker when that was built, so I flew the Fokker, landing uphill and then always taking downhill.
Yeah.
It worked out pretty good
mm-hmm.
there. Of course, the northeast wind was prevalent there most of the time. I had to be a little careful about
mm-hmm.
that. I don't remember taking off uphill. There was a slope there. I could take off uphill and go out to the right.
Mm-hmm.
I did that with the Hissel Standards.
Mm-hmm.
They'd get off right away.
Well, you know, sometime during the 50s, when I used to make the mail run out of Nome all the way to Bethel, we'd make 9 stops going down the coast to Unalakleet, and then we'd start from Unalakleet down to St. Michael and Hamilton, then Aleconuck and Quigook and Mountain Village and Pilot Station and Marshall, and then hop from there down and over the Devil's Elbow, we called it, and the Big Bend of the
Yukon
there, and go on down to Bethel. Well, there was an old postmaster down there at Aleconuck by the name of Christensen. He was a Dane.
Oh.
And he was the postmaster down there in those days. Well, he was a pretty old fellow when I knew him, but he had first come from Denmark and come over to this country, and I think he went to work for Kramer. Or he said he worked at a dairy farm or something here in Fairbanks before he finally, you know, wound up down the river there.
Yeah.
And so he was here sometime in the 20s when that Fokker was here, because he had an old album. He had some pictures in it, and he had the picture in there where there was a major of some kind here in town that had flown that Fokker or made a trip or two with it, and he'd gone up on his nose with it there at the ballpark at Weeks Field. And this is what he told, anyhow. And there was a picture, he had a picture there of the major and whoever it was that was flying that old Fokker that day out there.
I never heard of anyone else flying it, but Joe Crossan and I.
And there was no other Fokker up here?
No. Not
he had these pictures.
Not in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
No, we had the next Fokker, Super Universal with Pratt & Whitney 420. That's what NAT had bought, and then when we merged, we were using it. But I carried a major, I believe, in the Fokker to Fort Yukon.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's right.
Could have been the same man. This fellow could have gotten his story mixed up or something. I don't know what happened out there, but the field was soft or something, and it was in the springtime, and I think the Fokker had.
He may have made a story out of it, too.
Yeah, he could have.
No, well, it never nosed over.
Yeah. And I don't know.
I knew its history fleet
mm-hmm.
from here, because it never flew after, it really never flew after I flew it in 1925.
I see.
For a short period for Fairbanks Airplane Company. Joe Crossan didn't like it, although he flew it a couple of times, but he had that trouble with the rudder at first, scared him badly, and then he had trouble getting the right speed down. He flew it a few times and said, "Oh, I don't like it." But he was flying the Hissel Standards that they built up. They built one into a five place. And it sat there most of the time. And I watched it closely, and I would have heard, many people would tell me, if it flew. And it just didn't fly anymore. And Fairbanks Airplane Company wanted quite a little money for it. They wanted $2,500 when it was unfit to fly. It sat there too long.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have the money to buy it for historical purposes and such, although it would have paid someone to do that. But it just went to ruin, and it was bulldozed or chopped up, and the engine laid over there between the residences for quite a while.
Hmm.
Bob Reeve came up here a little later and wanted the engine. So I went over there with him. Sam White and I went over and took the propeller. The propeller was still on the engine. And I still have the propeller. Oh, it's in Richard's house, if you ever want to see it. And we got the propeller and left the engine, because the engine was heavy, 750 pounds, and we had to hire someone to take that. But Bob wanted it bad, and we couldn't find it anywhere. We know for sure they just bulldozed it into a hole.
Well, that's a real tragedy.
Oh. We know so little at the present time, you see. It's always the present time. Will it ever be worth something, or historically?
That's right. It's hard to have a sense of history about the present time.
Same with our old Hissel Standard.
Mm-hmm.
We bought it for $750 and fixed it up, and then we sold it to a fellow in Nome for $750.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Roust. He couldn't fly. He'd had a ride in the air. I think he handled a stick for 10 minutes or something like that. So he thought maybe he could fly, and he was going to taxi. He was going to practice by himself like the Wright brothers did. And a cool air over there and more wind than he thought, and he didn't realize what big wings. And high
there he was at 10,000 feet in the air.
High lift wings they were, with a curve underneath, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They lifted right away. And he was taxiing, what he called taxiing.
Mm-hmm.
So he taxied a little faster, just to feel it, you know. And he was in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And then he didn't know what to do. So he gave it a little more power then and flew around 15 or 20 minutes. Then came in and tried to land.
Mm-hmm.
He stalled above the ground because he wasn't used to seeing how it should look,
mm-hmm.
or where the wheels or skis should be.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had made skis and put on it.
Mm-hmm.
It was winter and it's cool air. And he stalled from about 10 feet and it dropped forward. And he flew out, clear out, over the top wing, but didn't hurt him a bit, and landed in the snow over, never forget, he told us all about it. Well, he busted something on it, I forgot what it was, and he got it fixed up again. Then three or four boys over in Nome decided they could fly too. Well, I don't know how they did it. But we knew most of the boys that did it, or that they said would be the only ones that could do it. And they wrecked it. They tried to fly it. Poor old Tom Roust lost his airplane, and of course, we got paid $750, but now you can't buy them for $20,000.
Of course, sure.
I tried, 18 years ago, fellow Kirkpatrick, who became wealthy later, Max Kirkpatrick, down Anchorage. He had General Motors dealerships, and he had a coal dealer in Union Oil, Well, and then he invented a drilling machine that he got $2 or $3 million for, coal drilling, mining.
Mm-hmm.
Great big 12-foot bore or something like that. So he became wealthy, and he says, Noel, if you can find a Hisso standard, I'll buy it. I'll buy it, and you make that flight then from Anchorage to Fairbanks again, like you did in 24, the first flight. Then, he says, I'd like to keep it in Anchorage. And, you know, I tried for a year or two to locate. I tried through the AA, let's see, what they call it, Antique Airplane Association.
Oh, yes. AAA.
AAA, I think
yes.
They called it. That's in Wisconsin headquarters. And I put stories in there, and I put ads in, asking in a story way, if anyone had a Hisso standard that they would sell. Well, I located one that was rebuilding a Hisso standard, but he would never give me a price, and it was because he just didn't want to sell it. And finally, he wouldn't answer me. Excuse me. His wife would answer me in New Hampshire. I still have his address, but
he's attached to that airplane.
Huh?
He is attached to the airplane.
Oh, yes. He was. He just wasn't ready to sell it. And no others came or wrote me or let me know anything. So I just didn't find one. Isn't that strange?
Yeah, it is.
There were a few
what
thousand.
Airplane did you make your first flight on? When in Minnesota, was it?
Yes, that's where I learned to fly.
Mm-hmm.
Minneapolis, St. Paul. I recently saw a picture from the air of the little hangar taken back then. Good and sore here. Throat. Drink some more coffee. That'll fix me.
Well, there was a lot of Jenny showed up in the United States after World War II because the military had so many of them left over.
Thousands of them.
Yeah.
I think there were 10,300 OX-5 engines
mm-hmm.
built, and almost that many Jennys, JN4Ds. I noticed that in some of these write-ups here that some of the press felt that the Hisso standard was a Jenny.
Yeah.
And they call it Standard J1 Jenny. I was just reading one yesterday from the Newsminer, I think. But they're two different airplanes. Entirely two different airplanes.
Who manufactured the Hisso?
Gates Day Standard in New Jersey. And Curtis Company built the Curtis JN4D.
Which is where it got its name, the Jenny. The JN.
Yes, that's what
mm-hmm.
what gave it. The JN, Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
Jenny was easy to say. I learned to fly on the Jenny OX-5, the single magneto. It had the OXX6 with two magnetos and rated at 10 horsepower more. They rated that 100
that
horsepower.
That was in what, 1920? Right after World War I?
Yes. They were building them to last part of World War I, training American pilots. So they had these two different airplanes that they were building for that purpose. And the Canadians built the Curtis II, called Canuck. Just a nickname, Canuck. But they had a smaller rudder on them, and they had double ailerons, and the wings were almost identical. I don't think you could tell them apart. That was called a Canuck. And they were built in Canada under Curtis license.
Did your parents ever come up to Alaska?
Yes. I bought their fare to come up when we were married in 29.
Mm-hmm.
We both came up. My mother ahead of my dad because he had work to do on the farm before he could come. But he didn't come for the wedding. He couldn't come. But he came just afterwards. So I flew them over to Nome, both of them. And I remember I was flying Ben Ileson over to Nome. And my dad and my brother Ralph, same time. I think we were dickering then to sell to American Airlines, and Ben Ileson was the manager of it, or representing them, buying them out, and he was to be the manager here then. They did buy us out, we in Alaska Airlines, fall of 29. They also bought Bennett and Rodebaugh out, who were our competitors here on the field, and they bought Anchorage Air Transport out, which was Russell Merrill, Sean Beck, and other businessmen down there in Anchorage. So they bought three companies out in 29. And that's when Ben Ileson became missing, because I hadn't had a honeymoon yet from May 19th until September, when we sold out. So I insisted on going out, so did the wife, going out for a trip. We'd been a few months hard work here. So Ben Ileson then flew the Hamilton that I had been flying, and I'd been over to Siberia this spring of 29, one flight, see, to get these fur off the LSF boat.
That's right, you made a trip over there before he went over there, didn't
you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
The spring before, mm-hmm. I went over in March. The weather was good then, but fall, he went over there in the fall because the Nanook, the other boat identical to the LSF, they were ice boats.
Mm-hmm.
Captain Bob Bartlett, famous for his Arctic work around Greenland and in that area.
I first met him when I was a Boy Scout back east. He came down and gave us a little talk one time. But I used to read about his experiences up there in Baffin Island and around.
Yeah,
you know,
all through the
back in the 20s.
That's the boats. That's the two boats that we're using.
And he was on the Karlik got wrecked over there at Wrangell Island that time for Stephenson.
Is that right?
He was on the Karlik.
I remember the name Karlik. Mm-hmm. Oh,
that
yes, I read
about Stephenson's first boat, you know, that went up there in 1913.
I remember.
Had all his books and everything on it, you know. And then
they
went over across the north coast there as far as Camden Bay. And Stephenson and somebody else in the party, an Eskimo, had gone ashore with a dog team to see if they could get some fresh meat.
Oh.
They tried to get some caribou over there. And while they were there, the wind came up and the ship got out into the ice off of Camden Bay. And then it started to drift on back across the coast there. Well, Stephenson never got back on the boat again. He took up with that party that was at Collinson Point, which was actually the point that stuck out there at Camden Bay, just to the west of Barter Island, about 40 miles. That was part of that Stephenson expedition that was up there in 1913-1918.
Yes, uh-huh.
And so he went with that group, but Bartlett had gotten out into the ice there.
You know, see?
Bartlett was raised in Newfoundland.
Oh, he was. Right?
And back on the east coast there, these old ships that used to sail up into the ice up between Baffinland and Greenland and up in that area, if the ice would get bad, they would move from shore out into the ice because the ice was drifting south and it would eventually break up out into the wide North Atlantic there,
sure.
But up on this north coast, the theory of the old whalers was when you got the ice got bad was to stay between the shore and the ice, because if you ever got out into that ice pack, you might not ever get out again.
That's true, isn't
it? See, so Bartlett wasn't that experienced with this kind of ice at that time, and he got out into the ice and they never got out again. They came pretty close to Cape Smyth over there near Dees Inlet. And
that was the Karluk.
Yeah. And I think a few of the Eskimos got ashore there. A few of the people.
Oh.
They got ashore. Everybody could have gotten ashore, but they elected to stay on there because they figured they'd get out into that open lead that is usually
parallel
off
to
of
the
Barrow
coast.
And north east of Barrow. The current goes up there, and there's usually an open lead. They figured they'd get out into the open water up there, but they never did. And they stayed in the ice, and that thing went way on across the Siberian coast until they got off of offshore from Wrangel Island there. And finally, the ice moved in against the shore ice that was piled up out offshore from Wrangel Island there. And that was where the ship was finally crushed and it finally sank. But everybody, one way or another, made their way
onto the shore there.
And some of the people were lost trying to get ashore there, but they finally did go ashore on the Siberian coast over there, and that was the end of the Karluk.
Well, now the ship that he was with in when you were there, where was it? It was on the south side of East Cape, wasn't it?
No, not near East Cape. No. 400 miles up the coast at North Cape.
Oh, it was.
Yes.
Way up the coast.
Oh, I didn't. When you went over there.
Yes, we went to North Cape.
I didn't know it was up there. I see.
Yes, it was 3 miles offshore, and we landed what had been an open lead, but drifted very rough, 1 mile off North Cape. So we got by with it, but it was very rough. In the fall of the year, Pollister, the manager of the boat and the fur buying, said that it blew 40 to 50 miles an hour for 30 days straight without a single let up at 30, 40, and 50 below. With that extreme temperature and high wind, the snow gets so hard. The temperature is what makes it hard. And the dog sleds were just sliding off all the uneven places sideways. The runners wouldn't cut in at all. Mm-hmm. You couldn't put your heel in it. Of course, we had mucklucks on. Couldn't anyway, but they had such an awful time to cut the drifts down in this big open lead where I landed. And they used shovels, and maybe they had a pick or two, but they worked hard and long on taking the bumps off. But the bumps are so hard, and my shock absorbers were froze up, the aero oil, by a pneumatic tool company, Cleveland, air and oil, but they had the wrong oil in them.
Mm-hmm.
And even 40 below, and we were there in March, and that froze them solid.
Should have put some seal oil in there.
Well, we hadn't had any cold weather in Alaska at the time, and they were working okay at 10 below, 20 below, and then the air was warmer. But here the air was 10 below all the way up at 6,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget it. So they were froze all the time. And then when it got down into 20, 30, and 40, finally on the ground, they were solid. Just like everything was solid, including the ski stands.
Mm-hmm. Well, you didn't have shock struts on the ski stands at that time anyhow.
No, we didn't. Pan American or Alaskan Airways had a type of ski stand, but they weren't very good. The shock absorbers were right in around the axle, and they tipped this and that way, and you couldn't steer the thing. I flew them some, and horrible thing.
Mm-hmm. I flew some of the first ones that had the shocks on them. They were the old Wesco skis, and they had the shock on the front.
Oh, yeah,
that
the front.
That was a wonderful ski.
Air oil. Yeah, we used them. They were all right. They wouldn't tip like those fabric or rubber things that they had.
Of course, these had black iron on the bottom, and they were made of laminated plywood.
Yeah.
Every summer, we'd change the iron on the bottom of those things.
Wesco skis. They were good skis, there's no doubt.
Ski.
Well, We landed there, you know, and Doc Cripe and I just bounced right off the seat. Gee, it scared me. I thought sure we were going to break a fitting on that landing gear. And then, of course, we had to take off on that, too, with a full, a heavier load, full tanks of gas, and 1,100 pounds of skins is all we could get in the eight-place airplane. We had 1,300 and some pounds in by putting them back in the fuselage, back of the laboratory restroom compartment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was halfway, well, better than halfway from the wing trailing edge to the tail stabilizer. And I noticed, of course, we got poor Russian gas up there. We were wiring or talking by wire, telegraph, see, between the boat and Nome. And they said they had plenty of gas, Russian gas up there. Well, we thought it might be all right, but it was very poor, and my engine sputtered. So my first attempt on taking off, I couldn't get the engine to take full power. Put. And you know you only get about half power then, see?
Was that the Wasp C that was in there?
No, the Wasp A.
Wasp A.
First model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw one over here at Chitna this summer. There's an old Hamilton laying over there, you know, and the engine is just laying on the ground. Well, when I first looked at it, I thought it was, it looked to me like a lot like the old Wasp C, but of course it was probably, that one could have been the Wasp C, I suppose. But
yeah,
it
could have been.
There might not have been a heck of a lot of difference between the Wasp A and the Wasp C.
No, there wasn't.
I first got my A&E license in 1939 on that old Wasp C back in Newark, New Jersey.
Oh, you did, huh?
So I knew that engine real good.
Oh, they were good engines.
Yeah.
Ah, they're good.
But this one didn't work on, it was a Wasp A and it didn't work on the
Well, with that poor gas and the 40 below, and we didn't have any special carburetor heating on it, just what Pratt & Whitney had put on.
Yeah.
One exhaust going through.
Well, they had a pot about this big between the carburetor and the engine where you ran the exhaust gas
through it.
Was that the
That's what it was.
That was a Pratt & Whitney installation.
Yes, and it wasn't quite hot enough in that 40 below for poor gas. But we finally got it to go. I stopped then. I knew I couldn't get the tail up proper for a 2,000-foot run. And the engine wasn't turning up as fast, of course. The prop wasn't turning up. I had that 10-foot Hamel standard metal prop on there. And that cold air would keep it from getting revs, and you don't get quite the power for takeoff. So I turned around and came back, unloaded 200 pounds of phosphor. Boy, did that hurt Hollister. Man, he says, we want to get them. They're $50 a skin here, and they're worth $150 in New York. And it was a high price at the time, and the market might drop any time. So the quicker they got them there, the better. And they had four more trips for me if I wanted to make it with white phosphor. Well, the second attempt then, by stopping the engine and letting the engine heat from base out, or the cylinders in, heated the whole engine. It always does. If you keep it running, they keep cool.
Yeah.
And I found that out on the Trimore Ford. They'll spit and sputter all the way off if you leave them running. But if you stop them and cover them up, the heat penetrates all parts of the engine, and they work pretty good. So. We unloaded that, turned around again, 1,100 pounds in there and 140 gallons of gas, and we bounced, and the engine took. It it hit on all, it was pinging though, because of this poor gas, but it was warm enough that it was hitting fine, developing its power. There's no spitting, you know. Boy, that cuts your power down. So we got off. Oh, well, we're tickled, too, you know. Right up over the 10-foot rough ice stuff, you know. Oh, that's rough over there. I got pictures showing the boat down in there and all that rough ice and the drifts 300-400 feet long from every ice cake, hard as a rock. That's quite a picture. Yeah, just an air shot. It took movies, and then I made stills out of the 35mm movies that I had. And this film that we in Airlines are making now with Frank Brink. You know Frank Brink? He's really great at making pictures, drama and all that. He's making a half-hour picture and has many of my movies, including the Siberian movie I took. I bought a camera just for the trip at DeVry that you wind up. Still have the camera, too. But Disney made for us this old film into new 16mm film. That's what Frank Brink is using. So he has the film I took on that trip. But I didn't get good film like takeoffs and such. I had to do the work, see?
Yeah.
But I got air shots of the Diomedes and up there and around the airplane and the loading and showing the baled sacks.
And you got the ship in the ice.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which really is quite a picture to have.
Yes, it is. It's picturesque because of these long drifts and the cake ice. Boy, that's a windy, dirty place.
Were there very many Eskimos, Siberian Eskimos?
Yes, there were quite a few from the village out there, and the Russian governor.
Oh.
It shows him in one of the still pictures I have. He looked like a typical Siberian tough guy, you know.
Yeah.
Thin face and wiry looking, but not very big. Yeah, it's very interesting. So, three captains of the boat, and Pollister, the manager.
Gee, that's wonderful to have those pictures. That was a bit of foresight there to get that camera.
Yes, that's right. I didn't know much about it and didn't take good pictures, but I did get something. And the weather was so cold, I had to be sure that it was running, because it got cold and it stopped on me once. But then I had to warm it up on the heaters and the exhaust. But I kept it up front going up. That's when I got the pictures, mainly because I could get into the cabin. Coming back, we had the bales right to the ceiling, solid in there. And we had to get out the hatch on the top, Doc Kripe and I, in and out.
Did you stop at Teller on that trip?
No. Oh, nonstop from Nome.
Yeah. Well, that was where Allison and that group was.
Yeah, they were
Weathered in for a while, I guess, before Allison finally took off.
2 weeks or so there, and that Frank Dorbent that was flying the Stinson biplane that I had before, he was making life so miserable for Ben Ileson, and he was mean enough to take off in bad weather, and then telling Ileson, he says, "You have no guts," he says, "you're afraid," and all that sort of thing. Others have told us what conversations went on. Mr. Durbant was a mean. He'd been in a reform school when he was a little fellow, and no one could control him. The Stinson brothers, Jack Stinson and Eddie Stinson, told us all about him. He'd been working for them. And when he came up here for Anchorage Air Transport, he wanted to come up here and fly for me. He wasn't getting along with them down there because he was mean and drinking heavy all the time, getting married every so often, and he was a peck's bad boy, you might say, all the way up. Well, he says, "I've got 6,000 hours or I don't have an hour." He says, "I would like to come up and fly for you." Well, I was gullible and I said, maybe he's all right. I heard nothing.
It's so easy to believe people.
Yes. He was a big fellow and looked like he'd make a good pilot. Well, we hired him. And then we had all our troubles, you know. He'd come out drunk. And he wanted to fly the Hamilton. Well, I checked him out first on the Stinson biplane. See, that early one that we bought from Sir Hubert Wilkins. Built in 1926 with the Wright J-4B, 220 horse. It was a good airplane, very good. Well, I had the Hamilton now. And but I'll tell you about the Stinson. I gave him a checkout ride, and he came in for the landing. We took off and then came in for the landing, and he started landing at 10 feet like this. Mm-hmm. Man, I says, worse than a student pilot. But he finally found the ground and got it down. But this, I believe, was the first cabin airplane he'd flown, sitting in front. Mm-hmm. And it was, well, it was hard for him. He didn't know the first thing about it, mm-hmm. 6,000 hours. So, well, he got by, and we hired him. But nothing but trouble from there on, until we sold out. Mm-hmm. And he gave Eielson an awful lot of trouble, everybody connected with. Well, then I'll say, I checked him, I didn't check him out in the Hamilton, I just gave him a ride. Mm-hmm. And to see, I left, put him in the right seat. I didn't want him in the left seat, because I wanted to be there, because I didn't have much faith in him then, by that time. And he was drunk, and I couldn't tell it. Mm. Too much liquor. Boy, oh boy, the way he banked and turned around, you know. He wasn't a good stunt pilot either, but he could bank mm-hmm. and do dives and this sort of thing where he was right side up mm-hmm. all the time. That's what he wanted to do, and he'd come over the field like this, and then he'd go and sideslip down like this, mm-hmm. just like a big show, you know. Mm-hmm. Then he'd overshoot the field completely. Mm. Well, it was a wild deal, and I says, well, I took the controls and I said, showed him, I said, this is the way you'll have to do flying here, and go back a ways, make a nice straight, even turn, and come in straight for quite a distance, so you can feel your seat of the pants, landing speed, mm. and all. Well, he did a little better then, but he couldn't help but cut short mm-hmm. and come this way, see? Mm-hmm. Oh, that was enough. I wouldn't let him fly the Hamilton for anything. It was brand new yet, you might say, yeah. 6 months old. So, anyway, when we sold, then we got rid of him, but Alaskan Airways still had him on, and that's when he was flying the Stinson to fly up the North Cape. Mm-hmm. They had both made one round trip up there for furs, got by with the weather.
That was in 1929.
Fall of 30.
30.
Fall yeah, of I 30, see, okay. And mine was...
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me, you're right.
Well, you said you got married in 1929.
29 and May 19th, 29. Yeah. And then that fall,
yeah.
in November,
yeah.
that's
yeah.
the worst
that's
month
right.
to go over there. That's when
right.
the bad weather comes. Mm-hmm.
That's when Eielson was lost.
And that's when he was lost.
Yes.
The second trip over then, they were 2 weeks between the two trips.
And Frank took off from Teller. He told him, he said he was going to go on over, and he got Eielson in the air?
He took off 10 minutes ahead of Eielson. And you know, he'd never see him again, naturally.
And he turned around and went back, didn't he?
Oh, he got to Bering Straits, and there was fog over there on the other side, and he turned right around and came back. He was a real coward for weather, but otherwise a good pilot, see? Turned out to be with practice
mm-hmm.
and experience, yeah, that we all gave him. Well, Eielson didn't see him. Mm-hmm. If he was under him, he'd never see him, you see? It's so hard to catch an airplane coming toward you.
Right.
Underneath. Mm-hmm. If he was same level, just above at the yeah. right place, be all right. But Eielson would be up farther, he'd climb right away. Mm-hmm. But Dorvant probably knew this and just came diving down close to the ground back to Teller.
Mm-hmm.
Never saw him. So he thought Dorbent had, Eielson thought Dorbent had gone on, so he just keeps on going through this fog, up and down through it, and finally got into fog. He couldn't see anything, and he didn't have an instrument rating. And he had only a total of 350 to 400 hours anyway. We've heard from his brothers, sisters, and such since. We don't talk about that part of it. He was a good pilot, and he had made Wilkins' polar flight. You see, he was a famous pilot then. He could have had 5,000 hours as far as